Okay, so I mean, I'm going to cover basically a coexistence of charge density wave and superconductivity in a few different systems. One of them is the supersolid that was supposed to have been discovered in helium-4. Then also I'd like to touch upon another system that is barium bismuthates, where these are perovskite systems where one has coexistence of charge density wave and superconductivity. Then also you have systems like barium bismuthate, when it's doped with potassium or lead, one has this sort of a coexistence phenomena. Then you also have niobium, diselenide, and tantalum, diselenide, and so on. These sort of systems also exhibit coexistence of charge density wave and superconductivity. So what is special about these systems is, I mean, you have simultaneous existence of both off-diagonal long-range order and diagonal long-range order. Typically, I mean, it's supposed to be contradictory. Like, let's take the example of helium-4. I mean, it's a solid which has, which is a crystal, and it is, if it is a super solid, then it also has a superfluid property. So the two seem to be contradictory. And this was an idea that was proposed some time ago by Chester, then Lifshitz and Andreev, and also Leggett did some calculations which showed the how it can be possible. I mean, the basic idea is, if you have a crystal, a crystal of atoms which have which are light, then the zero point fluctuations actually can produce vacancies, and the density of these vacancies estimated by Leggett is sort of the order of 10 to the power of minus 4, and so these vacancies in the helium crystal, if they both condense, then they can form a superfluid. So that's how you can have simultaneous coexistence of a solid as well as a superfluid. Then, I mean, only recently in 2004, Chan and co-workers, they observed what is called as non-classical rotational inertia. Basically, what they mean by that is the moment of inertia is what is classically expected, but then it gets reduced by the superfluid fraction. Okay, rho s is the density of superfluid, and then this is the total density. So apparently what happens is, when you use a sort of a torsional oscillator, part of the helium atoms, they decouple from the surface. I mean, since they're a superfluid, they decouple from the surface, and they don't participate in the giving the rotational energy. So that's why you have this reduction in the moment of inertia. Then this actually was, I mean, some people try to reproduce it, and there's a little bit of controversy about it regarding the way it is prepared. I mean, apparently, I mean, some claims are that if you anneal the system, I mean, then this phenomena goes away. So the claim is that, I mean, there are imperfections that are created that are due to actually the way the sample is prepared. I mean, if it is cooled suddenly, you have a metastable state, and therefore the imperfections are created, and on account of this you observe this superfluidity, but otherwise it doesn't. So I mean, but I mean, it's a controversial issue. So on the other hand, I mean, theoretically, rather numerically, people have tried to find out if there are vacancies, but I suspect, I mean, when it is, I mean, vacancies are of this density, numerically it's hard to prove it. I mean, mean, I'm open for correction, but this is my impression.
It's easy. There's the big gap of the 13 Kelvin, and then at 60 millikelvin, there will be no vacancies around.
I see. Okay, but I mean, like
unless there are the crystal defects, and they carry the superflow then.
Crystal, well, okay. It's
grain boundaries.
I mean, okay. I mean, if it is not an intrinsic property of the crystal, then I mean, then there's no case for super solidity.
Long discussion. What is a crystal? A crystal might not be perfect. Still a crystal.
Perfect in the sense of in terms of preparation.
You can still have your core dislocations, lots of them.
Okay. Yeah, I mean.
Perfect single crystal will have no vacancies and will just be.
You're stepping in huge controversy.
Right. So I mean, I'll skip that. I only. yeah. I mean, I only wanted. At least people who are not familiar with it to be aware that there's a controversy. I don't intend to even. or hope to sort of throw too much light on the controversy. Okay, so fine. So this is one example. Then the other example is barium bismuthate. I mean, this has a perovskite structure. I may not be the best artist, but okay. Okay, so there are oxygens that lie along all these edges. There is bismuth at the corners. Just imagine that there's bismuth at the corners, there are oxygen along these edges, and there's barium that is sitting right at the center. Okay. So essentially, I mean, each bismuth is surrounded by six oxygens. It's an octahedra. So
it's a cubic structure?
Yeah, it is a cubic structure, right. It's a three-dimensional system. I mean, although my calculations are for a two-dimensional system, the ones that I'll be talking about, but actually, I mean, the case is even better for three dimensions, which I hope to show. And the other important point out here is the bismuth here and the bismuth here, they share an oxygen. So there's a cooperative distortion. It's actually, there's only one distortion that's allowed here, that's the breathing mode distortion. And the electrons that are involved are 6s electrons. Each bismuth is supposed to be in 4+, but actually there is valence skipping out here, okay? I mean, Verma has this picture that where he explains instead of bismuth being in 4+, it actually goes to 5+ and 3+. This is because of when you're in a 5+ state, there's an electron that can get transferred to the p state from the oxygen, and this produces nonlinear screening and actually lowers the energy. Okay. So, I mean, it's sort of a heuristic argument that was first given by Herring.
So you make an amendment that one can speak a bit on blackboard, but in the middle of it.
Okay. Yeah, I sorry about that. Okay.
You can look where you can see.
I'm very sorry.
Okay.
So 3+ has 6s2, and this one is 6s0. So when you have two electrons in the s orbital, you have spin up and spin down, and you can treat them as a hardcore boson. Okay. So you have a hardcore boson corresponding to the 6s2 state. So these hardcore bosons, the way the hardcore bosons are formed is due to electronic processes. It's due to nonlinear screening that comes about because an electron from here gets transferred to bismuth 3+ p state, and then that lowers the energy. I mean, it's a non-standard process, but since there are so many elements that have this valence skipping, there is at least some reason to believe that you can have actually these kind of hardcore bosons. So essentially, the on-site interaction is a negative U.
Can you please repeat, who is a hardcore boson?
Basically, it's spin up and spin down. Two electrons that are at a site, okay? Local pairing. A local pair is a hardcore boson in this situation.
So with the bismuth 3 and bismuth 5, they have a different energy. If one of them is lower, and then essentially it takes two electrons and you call it a boson.
I mean, the basic idea is bismuth 3 plus and bismuth 5 plus, when you divide that by 2, their energy is less than bismuth 4 plus. That's the idea. Okay. Okay. So this is one scenario where you can have hardcore bosons. And of course, helium 4, I mean, these are hardcore bosons. I mean, you know, Lennard-Jones type of potential is there, and at least the on-site case is hardcore boson. And I'm ignoring long-range attractive interaction for this. Okay. So these are two examples that I could think of. And of course, one can, you know, you can always think of a molecular conductor where, I mean, if you have, let's say, periodic array of, let's say there's a huge molecule here, molecule here, molecule here. If there's an electron here, if you have strong electron-phonon interaction that is intersite, then again you can produce a hardcore boson. And if these hardcore bosons, they couple to the internal degree of vibration of this molecule, then again you have hardcore bosons that are coupled to phonons. So that's another example. So I have at least three examples that sort of are useful for my minimal model. The minimal model is what is called as a Bose-Holstein model. I mean, typically in the Holstein model, one studies electrons that are coupled to optical phonons. There are very few examples where people, at least to my knowledge, where people actually study bosons that are coupled to this. One is the Davidoff soliton and stuff like that. So the minimal model is as follows. That is, you have B dagger I delta hopping to the nearest neighbors, then you have a coupling between the number density of these bosons and the displacement, which is local. So I'll write it as sum of raising and lowering operator, I mean creation and destruction operators for phonons, and then you have this. So it is as simple as this. Now, the interesting part out here is when you try to obtain an effective Hamiltonian for this system, what happens is, I mean, one gets more than what is called as the XXZ model, okay? But before I talk about the XXZ model, let me sort of give you what the effective Hamiltonian looks like and then explain how one gets it. So, I mean, as you know, if the electron-phonon coupling is strong, one has what are called as small polarons, okay? So, I mean, the usual picture that one has for the small polarons is, I mean, these are non-interacting small polarons, right? So, the question is, how does one go beyond this first-order approximation and get many-body effects? So, that's what we've been doing for the last few years, trying to have a controlled analytic treatment for this many-body interactions in this Holstein model and beyond. Okay. So the effective Hamiltonian looks something like this. This factor, the exponential factor, is due to the polaronic band narrowing, and then one has omega naught A dagger I AI. So this is typically what one gets from a first order approximation. So the additional terms that come about because of the many body treatment are the following. One is a next nearest neighbor hopping term, that is minus t e to the power of minus g square times t by g square omega naught. So d dagger I plus delta di plus delta prime. Delta is unequal to delta prime, and delta is nearest neighbor. Okay. Then, in addition to this, one has a nearest neighbor repulsion. I'll try to give you a qualitative picture for how you get these terms. I mean, I can go into a little bit of math, but I think you probably would be more interested in the qualitative picture. So you have ni times ni plus delta, 1 minus ni minus ni plus delta. Okay. So this term is nothing but ni, okay, number operator for the hardcore bosons. To remind you, hardcore bosons have this interesting property that on the same side they behave like fermions, on adjacent side they behave like bosons. So that's how the commutation relations behave. Okay, so qualitatively, how does one get these additional many-body terms? In fact, I mean, our claim is that the supersolidity comes about mainly because of this term, this next nearest neighbor Hopping term. Okay, if this term is missing, then this problem can be mapped onto the XXZ model. Okay, I mean, if one can always write S plus equal to B dagger I, then SZ equal to ni minus half. Using this, one can reduce this into a XXZ model if you ignore this next nearest neighbor Hopping. So XXZ model actually doesn't produce supersolidity, it only produces phase separation. Okay, so let me give you the punchline and then go on to the actual qualitative reasoning for this. So what we get is, for our model, if this is G and this is filling and this is 0.5, we get this kind of a picture. Here you have super solid, here you have phase separation, this is super fluid. And it's supposed to be symmetric about this. So for the XXZ model, it looks something like this. You have a super fluid and you have phase separated state, G being the electron phonon coupling constant. So this super solid region is primarily because of this. In fact, I mean, we have done a calculation where we ignore this and then just take this into account, and the results are quite dramatic. I'll talk about it a little later. So, okay, so let me try to explain qualitatively how one gets this. I mean, more rigorously, what one does is, one does what is called as a Langfitzer transformation. It's a non-perturbative approach where once you do the transformation, you produce displaced simple harmonic oscillators. Okay, so let me just outline the Langfitzer transformation, then give you the qualitative reasoning for this. So one does a canonical transformation of this sort, where S is given by the number operator times something proportional to the momentum, that is A minus A dagger I. Okay, so when you do this canonical transformation, one gets an H which goes something like this: B dagger BI times XI dagger dagger, then BI XI plus delta plus omega 0 A dagger I AI. So this term XI looks like this: T times AI minus A dagger I. So what this means is that each of these hardcore bosons gets clothed by these phonons. Okay. So once you have this, one does. When one decouples the charge carrier degrees of freedom and the phonon degrees of freedom, if you take the wave function as psi carrier times psi phonons, which is incorrect, then one can take the expectation value of this and this, and then the expectation value of X dagger I xi plus delta with respect to the psi phonons in the ground state gives you this e to the power of minus g square term. So that's how one gets this term. But strictly speaking, I mean, one should do a more rigorous calculation. And the more rigorous calculation, for the more rigorous calculation, what one does is, one takes e to the power of minus g squared, that is this term. It's just that we're adding this term and then subtracting this term out, okay? I plus delta plus omega naught a dagger I ai. I'll treat this as an unperturbed Hamiltonian, h0. And H1, which is the perturbation, will be nothing but this term minus this term. So minus T B dagger I, X dagger I, BI plus delta into H dagger I, X I plus delta minus 1. So usually people stop at this point, and this just corresponds to non-interacting polarons. So it turns out that one can do the perturbation with this in a very controlled way, and so we have done it to at least second order in perturbation, and so when you do that, one gets this result. So for that result to be valid, I mean, when you want to do perturbation theory, you have H prime N, N H prime 0 divided by En minus E0 terms. So you have the kinetic energy of these hardcore bosons and then these phonons. So you have terms typically of the order of e to the power of minus g squared times a constant plus some constant times omega naught. So if you assume that this narrow band system is such that this is much smaller than omega naught, then you can eliminate this quantity, and then you can sum over this ni, and then this becomes just for the phononic degrees of freedom, this becomes h prime divided by the En phonons only, okay, and then you have the electronics, electronic degrees of freedom. So these are just for the phonons, excuse me. Okay, so that simplifies the calculation. Okay, so this is an assumption that one makes to proceed further. So I'll try to give you a qualitative picture of how one gets this, these two terms. Okay, I mean, the qualitative picture that I give is actually it's in a more restricted regime. Okay, this one is valid when t e to the power of minus g square is much less than omega naught and g is greater than 1. If g is less than 1, I mean, you don't get such nice terms. But so for most quantities of interest, like here, the phase transition occurs for this is roughly about g equal to 1.5. I mean, it's greater than 1 anyway. Okay. So for things that I'm interested in, this works fine. So so the question is, how does one get this the next nearest neighbor hopping and then the nearest neighbor repulsion? Actually, it turns out that this nearest neighbor repulsion term, it's also relevant for manganites. This is what produces a ferromagnet, this conducting ferromagnetic medium in for these manganites in the CMR regime, in the colossal magnetoresistance regime. Okay, so so let's first look at this term first. So here is a hardcore boson that is hopping here and back. So I'll restrict my explanation to a more restricted parameter space, that is the small polaron regime, okay, and the adiabatic regime. So you can verify for yourself that this is a more restrictive regime than this regime. But so far I have a physical explanation only for this regime. Okay. So for this regime, the explanation is becomes more straightforward. First, let's try to understand how one gets this e to the power of minus g squared term. If you have electron or a hardcore boson that interacts with the lattice here, it produces a distortion here. And so when the electron tries to hop from this side to this side, not only should you take this this tight binding hopping term, but you should also take the overlap of the wave function for these ions, that is the simple harmonic oscillator here and the simple harmonic oscillator here. So when you consider the overlap of these two things, one gets p e to the power of minus g squared term that appears in the hopping of this charge carriers. So this is a conventional picture. So now question is, how does one get this term and this term? Okay. So I hope at least some of you are with me, or I've lost everyone. Okay. So when an electron or a hardcore boson hops from this side to this side and back, if you have an adiabatic process, I mean, here you have a distortion, okay? Whereas when it hops here and then back, this side, you don't have a distortion because it's the system can't respond fast enough. I mean, the hopping term is much larger than the frequency, so this side does not have time to respond. So when you do a perturbation theory, you have p square divided by the energy difference. Here you have a polaronic energy, whereas here you have an unperturbed system. So the difference in energy is g square by omega naught. And then a hardcore boson can hop here only if this is empty. So you have ni times, if this is I and I plus delta, so you have ni into 1 minus ni plus delta. Yeah, so that's how you get that term. So it's just simple perturbation theory, and recognizing that, I mean, adiabaticity requires that this side doesn't get distorted, whereas this one gets distorted. Okay, so for the next nearest neighbor term, it's a little bit more complicated. Actually, there was an error in the literature also. In 83, Fratkin and Hirsch, they to calculate this kind of a quantity, they considered only one diagram. Actually, there are two diagrams that are relevant. One is, if you have sites 1, 2, and 3, you can have a hardcore boson hopping or an electron hopping in this fashion. The other possibility is, if you already have an electron that is here, okay, there is a, if there is only a carrier here, then it hops here and here. But if initially to start with you have a carrier here and a carrier here, first this one hops this way and then this one follows this. So this is step 1 and this is step 2, this is 1 and 2. Oh, sorry, I should use different terminology. I plus 1, I plus 2, I plus 1, I plus 2. Okay. So when you consider these two quantities, one gets that term. To understand that, the intermediate state here does not get distorted because of this adiabaticity condition, whereas here it doesn't relax because as soon as the electron leaves, another one replaces it. So only the final states are distorted. So for the initial and final state, you have t e to the power of minus g square because this distortion here and here. And in between, there's no distortion. So t, and then the change in energy between this and this is again g square omega naught. So one gets this term. So this is the next term. And one can continue this logic to get what the small parameter of the system is. Okay. So that is important because we need a controlled analytic treatment for this problem. So I've done the calculation till fourth order perturbation theory. So the dominant terms are this kind of terms. So when I do a fourth order perturbation, I get, I mean, first term I go this way and then back, I get t square by g square omega naught. But then there's an intermediate state let's say this is 1, 2, 3, and 4. So when the electron hops back here, it has to be in a state that is at an elevated energy compared to what it was before. Because the perturbation theory in the denominator, I mean, the excited state can't be the same as the ground state. So the next time around, you have omega naught itself and not 0 here. So one ends up getting did I do this right? Just a second. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's again another P by G square omega naught. I mean, the upshot is you are supposed to get Tg by omega naught to the power of 4 times omega naught. Okay. So, let's add up. Yeah, that's what we get. So, as you can see, the small parameter is T by G omega naught. This is a small parameter. So as long as this is less than 1, my perturbation theory is kosher. So so we have done our calculations with this effective Hamiltonian, taking this as a small parameter, and then try to respect the condition that this should be less than 1. Okay. So we end up getting this kind of a phase diagram for how am I doing with time? I started late, right? Okay, great. Yeah, that should be enough for me. Okay, so so this is a small parameter, and okay, so let's try to understand what happens when I try to do calculations. I mean, calculations-wise, I mean, we used what is called as the modified Lanczos algorithm that Dagato and company had devised, which is a simple algorithm where I won't go into the details. It's a numerical algorithm where, okay, I mean, just to quickly tell you, you start with a ground state which has a linear superposition of all the basis states, and you hope that whatever combination of the ground state is contained in this, then you produce a state that is orthogonal to phi 0. Then you try to get matrix elements of the Hamiltonian for this, that is 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, and so on. And then you get the eigenstate for this, let's call that phi 0 tilde, and that obviously has lower energy than the starting ones. And then from this you get the orthogonal state to phi 0, and then you continue. And then you try to get the energy so that you reach convergence. So what we did was we tried to calculate things like structure factor, which we define as SQ. I mean, it's the standard definition for phi Q Ri minus Rj Ni minus expectation value of Ni times Nj minus expectation value of Nj. There can be a constant in front of it. Then we calculated both the Bose-Einstein condensation fraction as well as the superfluid density. It's an ongoing question. I mean, what is the connection between the superfluid density and the Bose-Einstein condensation fraction? So, I mean, we carry on the confusion. I mean, we calculate both of them. I mean, the superfluid density we calculate by imposing a twist in the boundary conditions. I mean, what one typically does is one says that, as you know, the superfluid order parameter, I mean, this is, I'm just trying to remind you, okay? The off-diagonal long-range order is can be understood in terms of this one particle density matrix. Okay, it's off-diagonal because I and G are not equal. And the superfluid density actually, rather the Bose-Einstein condensation fraction is actually equal to sum over ij of this divided by n or n and np or something like that. But I mean, you have sum over ing and then you get the Bose instant condensation fraction. But I mean, a more kosher way of doing it is the way that Leggett has proposed. That is, you calculate this off-diagonal, you calculate this matrix B11, B dagger 1, 2, and go for the largest eigenvalue for this. So that will give you the Bose-Einstein condensation fraction. So largest lambda is proportional to N0. Actually, it turns out that, I mean, when you do this for a translation invariant system, you can show that, I mean, you just need to sum over I itself. I mean, J is a general way, but for a translation invariant system, this is related to, it's proportional to this. I'll forget the constants. So you can show that one of the eigenvalues of this is this. So we could not show that, I mean, analytically we could not show that, so far at least we don't know why the largest eigenvalue corresponds to this translation invariant quantity, but numerically, both of them agree.
But it's not, it's the superfluid stiffness that's...
No, this is the condensate fraction.
Right, so both the condensate fraction, I mean, it can even be zero in some cases, and you can still have non-zero superfluid stiffness, so they're not necessarily connected to each other, right?
They're not necessarily connected to each other, but I'm not sort of trying to address this question of what is the relation between the two of them. I just calculate both of them.
But to characterize whether it's a supersolid is the
superfluid stiffness. I'm coming to that. Thanks for pointing it out. Yeah. So the superfluid order parameter is proportional to this e to the power of I theta. So if you impose a if you make theta a function of x, okay, which translates to putting a twist in the boundary conditions. I mean, what we have chosen was actually theta 0 x by L. We varied theta only in the x direction in our two-dimensional system. So, I mean, e theta 0 minus e 0, this is equal to half total mass times the superfluid velocity squared, the kinetic energy. So this can be written as equal to superfluid density, we'll call it rho s, times the total number of particles times the mass times h bar by m grad theta x. Okay? So from this, one can calculate a superfluid density. So this is how we calculate a superfluid density. So once you calculate a superfluid density and show that both of them coexist, that is, there's a peak in the structure factor and a non-vanishing superfluid density, then you know that they coexist. To figure out whether you have phase separation or not, what you need to do is look at the free energy. In this case, this is a t equal to 0 state, which is the energy. If the system is concave, then you know it's unstable. If the system is convex, then it is stable.
Sorry, what's your x-axis?
Oh, x-axis is number of particles. Okay. I'm glad that you're catching me. Okay. So, you know, maybe I should put number of particles or the filling fraction. Okay. So we use this sort of a criteria. So what happens is, if you look at the structure factor plot, this is S at pi pi. Pi pi is a wave vector for the charge density wave. Then the superfluid density concomitantly drops like this, but zero is here, okay? I mean, this axis is for superfluid density, so zero is here. So you have a non-vanishing superfluid density, and then you have the CDW transition. And then corresponding to that, I mean, initially, if you look at the energy curves, they're concave when this happens. This is at a particular value of G, let's say. As I increase G, G increases, you have convexity. So there's a regime where it's concave, convex, and then it becomes concave. So that's how we figure out that here it's a supersolid, and then later on it becomes a phase-separated system. The reason...
The calculation was now what? Exact calculation? Or?
Yeah, Lanczos. Modified Lanczos. System size is small. Okay. I mean, we've done it for system size of 4 by 4, 4 by 6 for verification, root 18 by root 18, and root 20 by root 20.
So just a few points on this curve.
Yeah, it's just a few points. That is true. But I mean, in all the systems, the signature is the same. So, I mean, okay.
If you would do the exact analyzation in infinite system, you would never get the concave structure because of the, because the system phase separates also in your calculation. And then you get the shortcut, you get the straight line.
That's what I'm saying, right? I mean, initially it is convex, okay? So when it is convex, I mean, I'm claiming that it's a super solid. So as I increase G, the curvature changes. No. So then it faces...
I'm just saying, in the infinite system, it would never get concave.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Once you cross the straight line, it's no longer... I mean, for a canonical ensemble, once you cross the straight line, it's no longer reliable, right? So, I mean, that's understood. Yeah, yeah. As long as, as soon as it becomes concave, it's understood that it's no longer... It phase separates, right? I'm only looking for the signature for phase separation, not going beyond that, right?
So this is the square leg, this is on the cubic.
Oh, this is two-dimensional system. I'll come to the three-dimensional case. Three dimensions, it's even better. So if it's valid for two dimensions, for three dimensions, it should be better. And also, when you have this cooperative breathing mode, it makes it even better. I'll come to these subtle points. Yes, sir. But first, let me get the basics right.
This is the, I understand that you were motivating by listing some examples, physical systems.
Right.
So, when I'm looking at this, I'm no longer supposed to think about the bismuth kallium.
Well, I mean, once you step into the realm of this this minimal model, I mean...
Kallium bismuth oxide.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm asking for the basic logic, basically. If you're talking about the barium bismuth oxide, mm-hmm. For instance, what's known about the transport properties of this material at low temperatures? Are there electrons still floating around, or it's all bosons?
For barium bismuthate, the pure barium bismuthate, there's charge disproportionation. It alternates two charges, zero charge, two charges, zero charge.
But if I measure, say, power susceptibility, would they see fine power susceptibility in the spin at low energies?
I'll tell you what I know. I mean, one of the problems with, as I understand with the system is, see, after high TC came up, this system got discovered just before high TC. The transition temperature was about 30 Kelvin. Once high TC came up, people didn't pay much attention to this system. Only every now and then I see this. I mean, even the phase diagram is a little bit controversial. So if you ask me very probing questions...
It's okay not to know. You don't know? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I know only some aspects of the system, okay.
And another one is, what is the definition of supersolidity?
Both the order parameter for OD, LRO, and DLRO, they are non-zero, and the system is homogeneous.
For the same component.
What do you mean by same component?
Well, take a superconductor.
Uh-huh.
Ions are doing DLRO, they're doing density modulation. And
oh, I see. It's for the same carrier, you mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, here the... Whereas here it is V dagger. I mean, the order parameter is just in terms of this.
Okay. And so then you saying that there is a chance that this barium...
Barium bismuthate, yes.
Is a super solid.
Well, it is a coexistent system where you have both superconductivity as well as CDW. I mean, here the Cooper pairs are local Cooper pairs, which are hardcore bosons. Okay. So in that case, I mean, whether you call it a supersolid or whether you call it a coexistence of superconductivity and CDW, it's the same thing, right? Okay. So that's what I'm addressing. Okay. So So this is a typical scenario. There's a simultaneous dropping of superfluid density, and this is the structure factor. This is how that behaves. And So the next question is, how do I know that this is the one that's causing it? Before I go to that, let me explain why I think at a higher value of G you have phase separation. As if you compare this with this, as G increases, this becomes small and redundant. So only this and this remains. So that's like the XXZ model. This is the XXZ model. So this is for our hardcore boson model. So that's the reason why you have phase separation large values of G. And we have actually done the calculation where, let's call this term J1, let's call this term J2, okay? So if J1 equal to 0 and J2 is non-zero, okay, that is next nearest neighbor hopping is there, then this transition is very dramatic. I mean, okay, what happens is this is for S pi pi, and the superfluid density drops here and then becomes finite. This is for rho s. So it happens at, I mean it's very clearly a first order transition. Not only that, the other interesting point out here is, which I think is quite remarkable, I thought it was true only in the one dimension, but even in two dimensions this happens. And that's what is remarkable about this. That is, below the transition you have equal occupation for both sublattices. If you have sublattice A and B, so NA equal to NB. Number of particles in A and B is the same. These are sublattices. So above, this is G critical. So at G equal to G critical, what happens is NA is equal to, I mean NB equal to 0, and NA is the NA plus NB. Okay. So, I mean, it reaches its saturation value at just one point. I mean, usually when you deal with, you can also think in terms of the magnetization picture. For a first order transition for magnetization, one usually has a jump and then a gradual attaining of the saturation value. But here the saturation value is attained instantaneously. So that's what is striking about this. This happens in one dimension, but...
S pi pi, so that's taking the spatial order, the CDW basically.
Right.
But it seems like it, this way, it really doesn't look like it ever goes to zero.
Which one?
S pi pi.
It is zero. It is zero. I mean, that's my...
Usually it won't go to zero, but you have to do finite size scanning.
Right.
When it goes to zero, possibly. And same thing for the superfluid density. Mm-hmm. If you want to establish a supersonic phase, you have to make sure the superfluid stiffness not go to zero when you increase system size.
Do finite size scaling.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, for the system sizes that we have chosen, I mean, it remains, and not only that, I mean, if I consider just this J2 and J1 equal to zero, this one is constant. The superfluid density above the critical value is constant. Okay. So it's not changing at all. So that sort of tells me that, even for the small system, the result is not too bad. Okay. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, if it were gradually tapering down or something, then, that causes more skepticism. But I mean, if it is a constant throughout, then...
One is a smooth... existence regions, another one is abrupt jump.
Yeah, this is where...
These two blocks, why?
I've taken nearest neighbor hopping to be zero.
And And the first one you draw on the one for applying.
Yeah, J1 greater than 0 and J2 greater than 0. Okay. Both are non-zero. So that's the realistic system. I mean, I just wanted to understand how the supersolidity is coming about. I mean, I already had a suspicion that this is the case because this is the only additional term compared to the XXZ model. So I just put this term and remove that, and then I get this. This is actually a new model. I mean, when you ignore the nearest neighbor hopping, this is like anisotropic next nearest neighbor Heisenberg model.
Okay. And the second case, because all the bosons are in one sublattice once you have transition.
In the second case, that is this case, yeah, all the bosons will be in one sublattice. That's right. But the interesting part is that happens at one critical value. It's not a gradual transition. It goes from equal occupation of both sublattices to one sublattice occupation at one critical nearest neighbor repulsion or one critical electron phonon repulsion, electron phonon interaction. Okay, so now coming to the question of what happens in higher dimensions. In higher dimensions, the coordination number, I mean, for this one is higher than this. If you take the ratio of number for next nearest neighbor hopping to coordination number for nearest neighbor hopping, this increases with dimensions as B increases. So this effect is going to be more pronounced in three dimensions compared to two dimensions, for instance. Okay. And the other point is, in barium bismuthate, you have two sites that share the same oxygen. Okay. So, I mean, if there is a hardcore boson here, it moves the oxygen here. So hopping to the nearest neighbor site is less favorable as compared to next nearest neighbor site. Okay. I've done the analytic treatment for in one dimension. I have to do it for two dimensions. In one dimension, that's quite clear. In one dimension, what happens is this term becomes g squared into 3 by 2. So for nearest neighbor hopping, you have e to the power of minus 3 by 2 g squared. So this becomes, at large electron phonon coupling, this becomes less important compared to this. This is because of cooperative electron phonon interaction. Okay. So again, for barium bismuthates, realistic systems, cooperative hopping helps supersolidity. Okay. So that essentially is what I wanted to say. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Any questions and comments? Did you think at all about long range? I mean, these are supposed to be Cooper pairs, right? So did you think at all about long range, you know, Coulomb interactions? Do you have some feel for
The way this Cooper pairs got formed, it was because of electronic processes. So once you've taken the electronic processes, I mean, you start with the Hubbard model of some sort, but then due to this electron polarization process, you have an effective negative U model. So after that, I mean, there's no other Coulombic interaction that one. No, I mean. So the rest of the stuff comes up because of this phononic terms and so on.
I guess as soon as you say phase separation and you have the X where N is written, then the less long-range Coulomb interactions are important. Because as you know, in a solid, in a 3D solid, there can't be phase separation.
Right.
So whenever you say phase separation, you always have to say.
Right. Just the Hartree terms will kill it, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so your
saturates
to 1 if
we mess
for whatever
the separation. No, it doesn't saturate to 1.
What is the relative over there?
Yeah, it's non-zero, but it doesn't saturate to 1. It actually drops, but it doesn't become 0. That's the point.
Is it from 1?
Close to 1. I mean, it's an interacting hardcore bosons. I mean, you have, it's not.
What's the number you got in your simulations?
I'll have to look up and tell you. It's.
I'm just asking if it's a percent or it's 98%.
No. It's 0.5, 0.6 as Donna was saying. Right. Yeah. It's less than one, definitely.
The only comment I think on the general level is that it's true that niobium diselenide and other materials do satisfy a nominal notion of the supersolidity, in the sense that you have an electronic component doing density wave and later on start doing superconductivity. So in this sense.
But the Fermi surface there is quite complicated, so.
Addition of the order parameters, so there is no Fermi surface.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, yeah.
So you have the same component doing basically both the density modulation and the off-diagonal Lorentz measure. So it depends how curious you want to be, but it's true that the electronic systems are super solids in some sense. And it's, the biggest struggle, I guess, is in the helium 4 case.
Yeah, I mean.
Part of the thing you said, I agree with.
Any other questions or comments? Let's thank you.